his basement studio in Wheeler Hill, Melbourne. And Harry and I have known each other since, well, at least about 2003 or 4 back in then. And I'm here visiting them for the first time in over a decade, and we just had a little Equinox celebration.
Double rainbow.
Unbelievable. Double rainbow while we were burning the sage and playing the flute right exactly at the moment of the Equinox.
But now, for once, Jeffrey, you have corroborating evidence.
Yes.
This is not just something that you said, oh, I was, you know, talking with three dolphins and three albatross came out of the air and wrote me a check. It wasn't like that. It was actually a real occurrence witnessed by three conscious humans and a dog.
Yes.
Except the dog doesn't see in color, so she didn't see the rainbow.
But yes. But man, I can't tell you how good it is to see you.
And it's nice to see you too.
It's really fantastic. And
you're weathering well.
And I could say the same for you too.
Yes.
It's fantastic.
But none of us are getting any younger, except possibly in spirit.
Yes, but when you say you're 70, you have to specify whether that's kilograms, inches, or light years.
Light years. Spiral. Actually, it's a spiral, so yes. It's all good, really.
So what is this music we're listening to?
This is called Snowflakes Over the Ocean. It's about... I was inspired by this idea that water is eternal. Water is the big thing that makes this planet different from a lot of other planets, which are, you know, like Venus, which is quite acidic and gaseous and a lot of sulfur, or Mars. There's a bit of water on Mars, but water is not, I wouldn't say entirely rare, but it's special.
But it's abundant on Earth.
Absolutely abundant and absolutely part of every living thing. It's our common element, and it is the most magical chemical that you could imagine, with its unusual chemical properties of, you know, maximum density above its freezing point, for example. For that we have to, you know, we can thank that for marine life, in fact our own life as well, because creates this extraordinary ability to trap heat or non-frozen water with ice on the top. It's like amazing. How come that happens?
You know, now let me ask you this. I was just talking the other day. As I understand it, because of the unique hydrogen bonding that forms in the water molecule, which is unlike any other substance, water, a contiguous body of water, acts like one giant crystal of water.
Well, that's one way to look at it.
I was asking that as a question.
Okay. Well, we could take it as a comment.
Okay.
That's all good. Yeah, I agree, but for me, what it's like is, you might need to edit this, but recently I was looking at this guy, you know those buckyballs, the plastic things, and you can buy millions of them, and they did this experiment in California about how to reduce water evaporation from large reservoirs, because it's a real problem, and they have these balls which they have now put tens of millions of them on reservoirs, and they basically...
I think I saw a photo of that.
Yes, and there's films about it. And actually, a guy did this experiment on YouTube where he jumps into it, and then he's underneath them, and he has to kind of struggle to get out. So it's not something to do unless you're a good swimmer. Interesting thing about that, though, that's exactly the experiment that I suggested as an analogy of how water works on a molecular level. So if you imagine an infinite plane of packed spheres, they will naturally form a hexagonal matrix. Now, if you drop one irregular shaped object into this, this will push all the spheres out, and the shape of the object will be reflected in the geometry of how the disturbances are out to the horizon, as far as it goes, right?
Like almost forever. Kind of like fractaling or something.
Yes, exactly. It's like creating a... I wouldn't say a fractal so much as an interference pattern. So
yes.
From the interference pattern, you can deduce the shape of the object.
Well, I love watching those patterns, and I'm wondering if the ability to detect information encoded in this kind of thing may be how Polynesian navigators and or whales and dolphins might derive information from water about things that are happening in the
heliocline. I'm sure also that they can smell and taste things in water that we probably with our jaded Western senses can't.
Yes.
But more to the molecular thing I was talking about, yes, on a molecular level. And that's not to say that molecules can't encode information. It's exactly what they can do. But my point about this is that, for example, homeopathy, everybody says you put a very small amount of an irregular substance in water and stir it and then keep diluting it and stirring it and keeping, and the more you dilute it, the more strong it gets. And the scientists in me, or in other people, well, in me initially, like, how does that work?
It's paradoxical.
How come less of something? It's paradoxical. So my feeling about this is that I started off with a positive effect, like I've had lots of experiences of homeopathy that have been beneficial. You could argue that that's the placebo effect, because that's definitely a very powerful thing. But just running alongside from that, imagine that you've got this infinitely variable plastic material, water, and in it you have imprinted, say, an arsenic molecule, right? Now, arsenic has this very strong heart tonic effect, but it's actually so strong that if you take too much of it, it'll kill you.
What do you mean it could be beneficial?
Well, a tiny amount, but you've got to get the right amount of beneficial.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to know how much that is. It's kind of picograms, you know, per liter or something like
that. Not much.
Not much, and very hard, very easy to get wrong, right? So not something you should do at home. But you can imagine, though, if you can imprint the pattern of the arsenic molecule in the water thinks, this is very anthropomorphic, but the water thinks it's got arsenic in it. The body takes the water, the body is mainly water itself, and it goes, oh, I'm taking arsenic. There isn't any arsenic there. There's just the pattern of arsenic. So the body reacts as though there were arsenic, even though there isn't any.
It was like your body's placebo effect.
That's exactly right, but on a chemical molecular level.
Yes, how interesting.
So that's my theory of how homeopathy works. And interestingly, when I saw these buckyballs in the pool, I thought, hey, so finally someone's taken it from a mind experiment kind of view to an actual, like, you can see it on YouTube. You can see how this would work.
Yes.
Because when you see the pools full of these balls, you can see them spontaneously arranging themselves according to where the periphery of where the diving board is. There's this thing that sticks out, and you can see the information about the diving board being reflected in the packing pattern of the
molecules. That's very, very interesting.
So anyway, over to you.
Well, look, wow.
You weren't expecting to go there, were you?
No, but that's so cool. But look, tell us a little bit about exactly who you are, your background in England, and you've been in Australia since the early 80s, mm-hmm. and you're very well connected with the kind of British international music scene, and you're a musician and producer and engineer and technician and mm-hmm. a luthier and a philosopher and many, many things. But tell us,
I have a stack of different hats, it's true.
Yes, tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, my father was a renowned British novelist who was very controversial, and I could talk about that for an hour.
But what was his name?
Henry Williamson. His most famous work, I'll take my glasses off.
Okay.
His most famous work was Tarka the Otter.
Ah.
And what was interesting about Tarka the Otter was that, as far as I know, it was the first book written about the natural world and its denizens, which was not anthropomorphic. So he spent an awful lot of time watching how animals, and empathizing with how animals behave, and he didn't give them telephone numbers and little jackets or,
yes,
you know, address books or conversations in their heads about consequences that are very human. He watched how they bit one another when they were angry, how they played, because otters are very playful, how they are, they remember through smell. And basically, yes, there are aspects of them that are familiar to us from our pets and other animals, but there are other aspects that are very unfamiliar, and he didn't try to gloss that over at all.
And so was he a zoologist?
No, he wasn't trained. He was born in 1895. He fought as a young man in World War One. He was very affected by the First World War, being in the trenches, that everybody who was there was very affected. I mean, the people didn't die. And the survivors were, you know, they were all messed up in some way or another. He came down to the West Country in England, and he was a motorbike rider. He had a Norton belt drive 2-litre motorcycle that it took him a week to get to Devon in the wet rain. It was 250 miles. Can you imagine? The roads were pretty bad then. They weren't tarred. It was all muddy roads. And he fell in love with the beaches and the freedom of North Devon, and it healed him. He had a little cottage there, found a girl, he learnt to sail, as I have done. They fell in love. He had a child, and while he was having the first child, who's now dead, in fact, Bill, lived in Canada, Bill Williamson, he wrote Tarka the Otter, and it was a great success. He'd written several books before that, but this one really hit the mark.
And what year did that come out?
1928.
For real?
Yeah.
Wow. That's 30 years before Rachel Carson.
Yes, she was influenced a lot by my father.
How fantastic. She's one of my biggest heroes.
Oh, she's amazing. Me too. Well, so he was very impressed by her work.
Yeah. Well, so he was like an environmentally aware person.
Yes, very much so. And he was very much into soil and soil chemistry and the necessity. You know, this is something that we will need to learn in the future if we're going to survive as a species, because it's all about soil. We are just the products of the soil. Because the soil, in a way, is like the biota of the world, in the same way as our digestion is our internal, you know, the second mind of the human is the digestive system.
Yes.
And the mind of the planet is echoed in the soil of the planet. The soil is very important.
Well, this is just a little footnote, because I don't want to derail your train of thought.
Easy to do.
Did you have a? Did you ever hear of an astronomer named Thomas Gold from Cornell? G-O-L-D.
I'll look him up.
He was legendary because not only did he give Carl Sagan his first job, mm-hmm. Gold was renowned for not only being a brilliant astronomer, but he would also make forays over into other disciplines where they were kind of like stuck on trying to figure out what was happening.
Right.
And
he
pissed off a lot of people because he was so good at solving problems outside his own area.
Very rude when you do that.
Exactly. They didn't really like that. He goes in there and because he could see stuff from a different way.
Yes.
The formal academicians in that certain discipline couldn't
see it. I was thinking exactly about this the other day. In fact, I was thinking about how sometimes you can come freshly to a subject with an open mind and possibly see things that people who live in this environment cannot.
You might instantly see it.
They are in the trees.
Exactly.
And they can't see the wood for the trees anymore.
You might instantly see something that they couldn't see because of their training. Mm. But anyway, but one of his, he wrote a book called The Deep Hot Biosphere. And one of the most, I haven't read the whole book, but I've read parts of it. But his main idea is that the vast majority of the biomass of all life on the earth is in the soil and down in the rocks and in the whole lithosphere, even down into the mantle.
If you do the numbers, that's true.
And these are beings that don't need oxygen or sunlight.
Yeah,
they're anaerobic.
Right.
And it also relates to the origin of petroleum.
Anoxic as well.
Exactly. Yeah. But it reminded me of what you were saying. Now tell us a little more about your background. Did you study science in college or...
Well, I'll start a little earlier. So when I was very little, when I was five, I started blowing things up and making bombs and guns, cannons, rockets and other stuff, timed fuses. And when I was six, I stole my father's Winchester repeater and shot anything that moved, which was a dangerous thing to do. I didn't kill any person. I killed a few birds, and once I'd killed a blackbird, I was devastated. I walked over to the blackbird and I thought, this thing was singing 5 minutes ago and I've killed it and I can't bear it. And I buried the gun in the woods in a grave. This at six.
Damn.
And my father noticed eventually that the gun was missing from the gun cupboard. And he didn't know what to do. So he called me over to him to his hut. He kept me waiting for an hour outside, so I sat waiting to be interrogated and or punished. And by the time I came in to see him, he'd forgiven me, because he saw that I'd thought about it. I was in tears. And I just punished myself, the best form of punishment. You know, you need to learn about rifles. They're not for playing with, for kids to play with, definitely not. Anyway, I was a wild boy. Anyway, so...
But then he picked up a guitar.
No, that was much later, about 12 years later, or 10 years later, less. When I was 12, I picked up a guitar. But, you know, I used to play the piano, and I got a scholarship to the Exeter Cathedral School. I used to play the organ in the cathedral.
Really?
As a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old.
Did you play Bach and stuff like that?
Well, slowly. I wasn't terribly good. I liked improvising. So I had the key to the cathedral. I used to go and play whatever.
Wow.
Which was fun, but only when nobody else was in there.
What cathedral was that?
Exeter Cathedral in south of England. Big Gothic cathedral. Not a big, not like St. Paul's or anything, but still a big cathedral.
How many cathedrals are in England?
I'd guess and say 20.
Because Winchester's one.
Yes, yes. And Salisbury, let's not go through the list of cathedrals. There's no cathedral at Glastonbury.
There's not?
No.
Okay.
You have to be a city to have a cathedral.
For real?
That's what makes a city a city. Okay. One of the things.
Well, so how did you get involved in when did you first become a musician?
Well, I was always a musician. So when I was 4, I went to school, and everybody at the school, my mother's school, had to be in the band. That's one thing. The first thing we did in the morning was play music together. I played the bass drum, and later on I played the recorder.
When you were 4?
4. Everybody in the school had to play music, and everybody in the school had to dance. And everybody in the school had to play kind of aggressive games of territorial conquest in the sand dunes, because the school was on a beach. Like, eccentric, but that's the way it was after the war in England. Because all the schools were blown up. Anybody who had a teaching degree could start a school, and my mother started a school, and it was a bit different. I'd say it's more like a Montessori school or a Steiner school. It was very adventurous. And
let me ask you this. Did you ever hear the sound of a V2 rocket?
No, I was at the wrong end of England. I'm not old enough. I wouldn't like to. I heard stories about them. My father describes them in his books.
Because part of it was meant to be a psychological a weapon of terror.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, the one he remembers more was the V1, which was the you'd hear the ramjet pop 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 or brrr, going like this as the little explosions, and then it would stop. When it stopped, you knew you had 20 seconds.
That's when it was going to fall straight down.
Yeah, that's when it ran out of fuel.
Wow.
So that's not a sound you forget in a hurry.
Yes.
Particularly if you lived in London or Kent, but we lived the other end of the country, 200 miles away.
Well, just kind of jumping ahead a little bit.
You
became involved in the very internationally known...
Oh, the avant-garde music scene
with people like Genesis and Pink Floyd and the Rolling Stones, and you were like a part of that whole...
Well, I was
culture.
There, yeah. So when I was growing up, I went to school at Millfield in Glastonbury in Somerset. And then after that, I went to Imperial College in London to read physics, 1969, and I was there for a couple of years, and then... Genesis was coming up the ranks. I knew the guys from school. We had bands at school. Some of the guys who'd been at their school had been expelled and came to the school I was in. We had a band, a blues band. I went to London, went to university, and during my time off from university, I would go and experiment with sound equipment and build pedals and make stereo guitars, and
this was 69,
70, 71.
Yes.
Start recording, built some tape recorders. Then in 1971, I heard that there was the first Glastonbury free festival, which had about 25,000 people at it, and that had I don't want to say in order of appearance, but David Bowie, for example, did a long solo set at dawn, which I was doing the stage at the time, so I remember it, and it was just like this far away. And he'd just been writing Changes. He'd done Major Tom, Traffic, Melanie, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown. Arthur Brown set himself on fire on the Midsummer Solstice and hung himself upside down from a cross in front of the stage, which was a pyramid from Egypt. I mean, it was out there. We created UFOs that flew across Glastonbury Tor in the middle of the night, and everybody came to the festival going, "I saw them. I saw them. There were seven of them. They were going from east to west and then back again. And then they landed." But they didn't land because yes. It was us with very bright lights
yes.
pretending to be UFOs. But anyway.
So now, was this around, what year was Dark Side of the Moon recorded? 1968?
Don't give me numbers and
But that's all right.
Dates,
but this is all that.
This is about that time. No, but I think
the vibe
later.
In the air. The vibe
so 71.
Air.
So at the end of 71, after Glastonbury and that big festival, Fairport Convention.
Yep.
Loads of people, lots of mud. I remember running through the cornfields chasing Twiggy, and nobody had any clothes on.
Well, I just learned her real name a few weeks ago.
What's her real name?
I can't remember.
Okay.
Something like Jane Fife or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, yes, yes. Anyway, she was very scrawny, but it was fun. Anyway, so I went back to London. 6 weeks later, I got a phone call from some guys who were the Grateful Dead's. I'd worked on the Fillmore East. Bill Graham was the promoter.
For real.
So Fillmore West and then the Fillmore East, which is in New York. They wanted to do the Fillmore Far East, which was in London. And they bought the lease on this thing called the Rainbow, the Astoria Finsbury Park, and they called it the Rainbow Theatre. And I went and lived there, and I was there till about 9 months, 10 months. And we built a huge PA system. We did acoustics. I learned about acoustics of buildings and how to do acoustic tests. And this is in the days before computers, before very many computers. NASA had computers, but we had the NASA circuit designers from the moonshot because they'd all done the moon thing and then they were all redundant and they were wondering what to do and they got into the rock business.
So. For real.
Or into communication generally. They're amazing to work with because you'd give them a problem and they would solve it from first principles. Like, okay, so I'll give you an example. We wanted to make this dimming system which would take 400 kilowatts of lights, RGB lights, red, green, blue, and dim them all so that it stayed white.
Really?
So now what happens is as you dim the incandescent lights, they get redder because the filaments.
Did you have to change the different colors at a different rate?
We had to create three dimming curves from scratch so that the red lights dimmed faster than the green light, which dimmed faster than the blue light.
Because of the different sensitivity to the wavelength.
That's right, but you had to do that from like first principles.
Yeah, it means empirical, right?
That's all. I was just getting a simple way of talking about empiricism. So. This is for your general audience. So, anyway, these guys, we had this working within a week. Amazing. Like, I was very impressed. Because I would sit, I mean, if I'd have done that on my own, I would have probably spent 2 weeks researching it.
Yes.
And then another week thinking about how to start doing it. And then another week thinking about what the circuit might, would take me months. And these guys had cracked it within 2 days, and it was built and working in a week.
And then from then on, everybody would know how that would be done.
Well, not everybody knew how it would be done, but yes, if they chose to tell them.
Ah.
They were very good anyway at this sort of thing. So we built these amazing lighting consoles. We had the Who, we built the speaker systems, we did the whole thing. And we lived in there, lived, breathed, and worked rock and roll. The Who was the first... first band, and Keith Moon smashed the dressing room every night for a week. So we got plumbers like on permanent call to come like every morning and replace all the china, all the porcelain in the dressing rooms, so the showers and the toilets and the hand basin. He just smashed them. Now he was fairly aggressive. We had the Birds, Santana, Chipperfield Circus, Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa was pushed off the stage.
Why? You mean accidentally?
On purpose, by a guy from the record company.
Really?
Because he'd
did he offend him?
No, he'd taken the tapes out of the studio in America and brought them to England because he wanted to remix the album in England. Didn't want him to do that. And he also wanted to re-record parts of the album live in Eastern Europe, and they didn't want him to do that.
Zappa was not somebody to let somebody else tell him what to do.
Absolutely no. He was a very entitled man. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But anyway, this guy, what I do remember is that we're doing the gig. Front of the stage, there was a 15-foot drop to, and at the bottom of the drop, there was a load of scaffolding poles kind of stacked up. Not a nice thing to fall into. And some guy came through the stage door, ran across the stage and pushed Frank, who was at the front of the stage, over, and then ran out. And we finished it, you know, we had to stop the show and apologize to the audience. It was sold out. And it was the end of the show, and they went, and then afterwards the police interviewed everyone. No one could remember what this person looked like. No one had any idea what they saw.
Nobody was filming?
No, but more to the point, how can you walk through a crowd? Like, there's a load of people there,
yeah,
and there's thousands of people watching, and no one could remember what the guy looked like. Like, how do you do that? Very professionally.
You have to open an X file on it.
Well, there was an X file, I'm sure. Anyway, so I'm very sorry. I mean, Frank took a while to recover from that. It was pretty bad.
Was he hurt?
Very bad, yeah. Really? He broke legs and he was really hurt.
Oh,
yeah.
So they could have killed him.
They tried to kill him, yeah.
I never heard about that.
In public, in the gig, during the gig.
What year was this?
1971 or 72, yeah. Something else. Early 72.
I never heard about that. So I got to meet him once in 1986 in Berkeley at a radio station. But another thing that was in the air just around the same time as Dark Side of the Moon, I mean, to me, all this associates in my mind was why when Stanley Kubrick was filming 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Well, have I got stories for you about that? But do you know, have I told you my stories about that?
No. Well, do you have time for one here?
Oh, well, I have a very short one. So the guy who built the HAL and also the ship called himself a purple Indian. His name was Pablo, and he was purple. His skin was very dark.
From India?
No, he was from America. He was a Native American. Well, whatever you want to call him.
Was he an indigo child? No, I'm just kidding.
And he wanted to experiment with consciousness, and so he had all this video equipment, multi-camera thing, and I was just told to be on a certain corner on a Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock, and so I went to this corner and waited, and a big white limousine arrived, and door opened, and I jumped in, and it was full of people, some of whom I knew. In fact, the girls they were called the Thunder Thighs. They'd been in Fellini's film, not Intolerance, one of the Fellini films, anyway, and the American actresses and singers, they sang with a guy called Hank Wankford after that.
Hank Wankford?
And they sang, you know, the three girls, do-do-do-do-do-do, and the girls sang, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, from that.
Take a Walk on the Wild Side. Yeah. They're the girls singing on that.
For real?
Yeah, yeah. And they were great harmony girls, and I sang with them. We were friends. Anyway, they got me invited to this party. We blacked out limousine. We drove out into the countryside of England. Came to this big place, big lodge, drove in, big sort of dwelling. Went in. Tables of food, tables of drugs. Lots and lots of rooms. I don't know, it was a health spa or some sort of resort or something they booked. And this weird party going on, and cameras everywhere, and Pablo was kind of mixing this live video of all the rooms, trying to get evidence for telepathy. So he was mixing people's conversations, and you'd get the beginnings of a sentence in one room, and then the next part of the sentence, someone coming out of another mouth, you know, two rooms down.
Was he creating it or monitoring it?
Who knows? But he was trying to document evidence for telepathy.
How many vials of acid were at this party?
Not so much acid. There was lots of other things, though.
Right.
Yeah. lots of other things, and little ampules of things and so on, and like experimental drugs.
For real? Was Timothy Leary there?
No, no, it wasn't that mad. It was more like Satyricon is the film that they were.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a bit like Eyes Wide Shut.
Well, you know, I know that was Kubrick's last film, and he didn't get to finish it. But
no, my niece did the finances for that film.
For real?
Yeah. She developed a financial management program specifically which is used in the industry, and that was the first time she used it. And she stood up to Kubrick when he tried to change the plan for the film. And she was one of the few people ever to stand up to Kubrick, because
he died during the making of that film.
I think he died towards the end of it. Yeah, it's a very strange film.
Well,
have you seen it? I imagine.
Oh,
you've never seen it. You should see it. It's up there with Rosemary's Baby, and you know.
Really?
Oh yeah.
I'm a big fan of his films, but
I'm not a fan of Tom Cruise normally. But the actual scripting is very clever.
Yes, well, I liked Tom Cruise in Minority Report, which is Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, that's a good film.
Yeah.
With a good script, Cruise is great.
Yes.
But you let him go and he's not great. He becomes all Scientological.
Oh, yes.
I don't have time for that.
That's something else we could talk about.
No,
let's go back to what about your relationship with the band that's one of the true legends of British prog rock called Gong?
Ah, yes. Well,
so you were an original member of that, right?
Yeah, well, I've got to show you this earbook here, you see. Look at that.
I've never seen anything like this. Robot Woman.
This is the Me Too movement.
For people listening to the radio
precursor.
Show, Harry's showing us it's the size of an LP.
It's
a book, and you fold it out, and there's four CDs, and then it's a book.
With 64 pages.
Beautifully printed color with text and photos and historical photographs of performing at Glastonbury and a bit of background.
And then
there's the story. It's kind of like a really high-quality comic book.
Cartoon, yes.
Yeah, it's really cool.
16 pages of panels.
And it's the story. Is this the whole story of Robot Woman from beginning to end? Or just
no,
chapter?
This is the first two albums. The third album we didn't have a cartoon for. Third album was recorded in Australia and it was a bit complicated. I think the first two more or less have most of it.
So some of the CDs are live and some of it's studio.
There are bits of it that were done live at Glastonbury.
And so this is, are you looking for, is a label going to distribute this for you?
That's already distributed.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's called Snapper Records, and it's called an earbook. There's a strictly limited number.
A-I-R.
E-A-R.
Oh, an earbook. Earbook. Ah, I gotcha.
Strictly limited edition, and in many cases, these earbooks have appreciated in value after release because they judge the quantities quite accurately, and they become collector's items immediately. And you can see the quality of the pressing and everything.
Can you save me one and sign it?
I don't know.
Be cool to have.
Yeah, I need to sign it in blood, probably.
Yeah, well, no, that's
but
okay.
Anyway, so
but
back
that's,
to Kubrick,
that's quite an achievement.
Which we weren't going on. But I did love 2001. I just absolutely loved 2001.
I think I told you before that I got to talk with Arthur C. Clarke on the phone twice in 1996, mainly because of my work with dolphins.
He was living in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And I sent him a painted rock and a T-shirt, and a few weeks later I got a letter back from him.
Wow.
And it had a page of handwritten stuff, and it had his phone number, so I rang him up, and the very first voice was a little Indian guy. He goes, Jeff Phillips, how are you? And he goes, like, Arthur would like to talk with you. So Arthur came to the phone, and his very first words were, Jeff, I'd really like to thank you for sending me that beautiful rock and the T-shirt and blah, blah, blah.
So
I wish I could have...
He was still conscious, basically.
Oh, absolutely.
Super conscious.
I wish that I could have recorded these conversations.
Big mind. He's
absolutely.
A big mind.
And he's responsible for the existence of the satellite.
Did he? Really?
Yeah, he wrote a paper in the 1940s specifying the trigonometry of how to put a satellite. You didn't know that.
No, I didn't know that.
10 years later, they did it for the first time. So he was a true scientist and a science fiction
writer. I knew he was a scientist, but... He wrote so many books about consciousness, basically, which I just love. I absolutely love his work.
Yes. Well, look, so...
And many other science fiction authors, too.
So did Gong ever... Was Gong inspired by science fiction?
Well, There are several gongs, and so gong was famous for being like a field of mushrooms.
Like a rotating
They
lineup.
Pop up all over the place. There are many gongs. There's Brazilian gongs. There's gongs in every continent.
As a band?
Different bands,
I never knew that.
Yeah,
I thought it was just British.
In different languages.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the central one, the first nest of gong spores popped up in as part of the Canterbury scene. David Allen played with Soft Machine.
Yes.
And
he's considered to be, he's like the founder of it, right?
Of gong, yes, with Gilly Smythe.
Yes.
And I met Gilly I met David and Gilly in 1971, which is quite early. They were going to play at Glastonbury, but they were late on the boat, but they actually are on the album. But I met them in London later in 1971. And then I met them again in various mysterious circumstances for the next few years. And then in 1978, I did some gigs with, I was playing with Nick Turner from Hawkwind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, we were doing the Book of Coming Forth by Day, which is the Egyptian Book of the Dead.
That's the true name. Called death.
Waking
up.
Right.
That's so cool.
And we were struck by lightning four times.
Yeah, you told me this
in the
that,
Green
you know,
Pyramid,
oh
which I built. It was a scale model of the Great Pyramid. Big mistake that. And it was all right, but it was kind of weird.
Did you? No one aged a day when they were under that, right?
One of the guys went completely blue.
What?
And when we were struck by lightning at Glastonbury, no one could believe it. The pyramid with 200 people and it was struck by lightning. And nobody inside felt anything. And outside, the whole ground was kind of bathed in blue.
Was Cheops offended?
Khufu.
Was he going like, how dare you?
No, he was fine. He was going, no, but you just need to adjust the angle of that leg.
Exactly. They'll change the voltage next time.
Right.
How funny. That is so cool.
Yeah.
Well, so
and at Findhorn, we had a double rainbow.
Now, what did you do at Findhorn? Perform?
We performed at Findhorn. We performed at the Edinburgh Festival. We performed all over the country.
Well, there's something magic about England. There's something
certainly
magic
are.
About
so,
it.
So, I mean, the Phoenicians came to England in, 5,000 years ago. And they wanted tin for their copper to make brass. And the Bronze Age came about with tin isn't available everywhere. It's quite a rare element to mine. And the Cornish tin mine's very famous. And actually, where I used to live, in North Devon, just down the road, there was a mine, abandoned tin mine. And they used to go and play there, but not very far, because they're very dangerous, those old tin mines.
So the Phoenicians came there 5,000 years ago to mine tin.
To tin, yeah, because there's no tin in Egypt.
Did the Anunnaki come there to get gold long before then?
Not much gold there, tin and silver.
Really?
Yeah, silver mines of Cornwall and tin,
well,
but much more tin.
Did the Romans do any mining, or did they just dig out stone?
By the time the Romans came, there was still mining, but the Cornish mines go under the sea, so they were problematic.
Really?
Because the water comes in.
Yeah.
And then that was a problem until the invention of the steam engine and pumps, and then they started pumping them out in the 18th century. But
yes,
that's a bit later.
Well, you went up. You mentioned 1978. By 1982, you had moved to Australia.
This is true.
How did that happen?
So I worked in the rock business. I worked at the Rainbow. Then that closed down in 1972.
When you were playing with these
bankrupt.
Guys, you were playing guitar, electric guitar?
Hang on, you're just jumping. I'm just going. So 1972.
Okay.
Then I'd been working with a guy called Ant Phillips from Genesis.
Yes.
And we got on very well together, and we wrote some music in open-tuning guitars. We really liked the open-tuning guitar because it removed the essence of consciously knowing what chords you were playing from the equation, so you just do things that sounded nice and were unusual, and we created some really rather beautiful music. And one of those major pieces was music for Tarka, which was for the book Tarka the Otter, written by my father as he was getting very, very old, and David Cobham was making a film of the book, and he led me to believe that we were under consideration for making the soundtrack for the film. But when actually we'd completed, but then we got the London Philharmonic to record the music, and we did our bit, the guitars bit, and then I showed it to the producers, and the producer said, oh, we've already got the music.
Yeah, I remember you told me that story. Yeah, horrific. It was your dad that wrote the thing.
Well, I know, but I mean, I shouldn't stand on any assumption that I'm entitled to writing the music, but it would have been nicer if they'd have told the truth. That would have been okay.
Well, I've heard what you did, but I have never heard what they ended up using.
It was pretty basic. It was okay, it was adequate.
Was it ordinary?
I don't want to diss someone else's work, you know. Yeah. It was okay.
Yeah.
But I think what we did was more epic.
You know how they used to say that you're supposed to watch The Wizard of Oz and play Dark Side of the Moon at the same time? So can we take the Tarka film and then play your soundtrack along with it?
Well, that would be plagiarism, I think, legally.
Well, but we could at least like sit and watch it.
We could show a bit of it, yeah. But nevertheless, anyway, so Anton and I had done this music, and pretty much as my father was dying, and
did he like it?
He heard the rough recordings just before he died, and he was in tears. He was absolutely joyful, and then it finished, and then we didn't have the film, and it sat there for 13 years until Amy International paid money for the rights to the recordings, because it had cost quite a bit. So Genesis Management, Hit and Run, who were in London, had paid for the recordings for the orchestra. The orchestras are not cheap. And anyway, that's the story of Tarka. But then after that, I joined Sphinx with Nick Turner and various other people, Mike Howlett and Morris Pert from Brand X, was a great percussionist, and various other people. Steve Hillage was on it. And then the lineup sort of changed in Sphinx, and we went on tour, and all sorts of people playing all sorts of things. And I built the pyramid, and we played all over the place, as I just described. And it was, you know, extraordinary and dangerous and wild and marvellous. And I mean, just in terms of, you know, visionary things, I remember driving up the M5 extension up the west coast of England up to Scotland, and overnight, and in the morning I saw an enormous Buddha in the clouds, like maybe 20,000 feet tall.
Really?
Perfect. And in the eye...
Do you have a photo?
I don't have a photo. I didn't have a camera. In the eye of the Buddha was sparkling. And I started driving towards it. I thought, I've got to see this. Like, I don't believe it. This is crazy. And driving towards it and driving towards it. As I got closer, I could see that the eye was a thermal in which a whole load of gulls were, or white birds, were circling up in the upper atmosphere, really high up. And we arrived underneath it, and there was Sami Ling, which is a Tibetan monastery in Scotland, in the lowlands of Scotland, as it were.
That could be the opening scene for your autobiographical movie.
Well, it gets better. So we arrived, and Steve, the one-eyed gypsy, went in and saw this triangular Tibetan bell, which I'd never seen before, like a pyramid, and he went, oh, I'll hit it, and it went clang. It was this little thing, and it was like 1,000 times louder than you'd think it ought to be at that size. And all around us on the fields there were people. It was early in the morning, they were digging the fields, and everybody stopped doing what they went, they all stopped. It was like someone had rung the fire bell.
Yeah.
And they all came into the kitchen, and we introduced ourselves, and it's like, oh, okay, then, well, welcome, you know. And then they went back to do what they're doing.
Wow.
So you're not supposed to ring this bell, right? It's like an emergency bell.
Yes.
And it come from Tibet. Henry Wolfe had gone over there and brought a lot of these bells back at the time when the Chinese had taken Tibet.
Well, let me ask you something. That makes me think. You know who Mickey Hart is, right?
Yeah.
The guy from the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to have a CD that was called Yamantaka, and it was It was Mickey Hart, a guy named Wolf, and a woman. And
this was probably
and it was Tibetan bells.
This will be the same.
So it was
guy.
That same guy.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah. So anyway, so we were encouraged to go and do whatever we wanted to do. So we went and did some digging, and then did a few things and had some tea. And I wandered into the place where all the bells were. And I chose a particularly large bowl and started playing it. And as I started playing it with a stick, wetting the stick, like the harmonics started building up. And I've played bowls before, but never one like this, ever, and never since.
Do you know which note this was on?
I don't know what note it was, but so you get the fundamental. And then as you press in, it goes up the fifth,
yeah,
and then up the octave, and then the ninth, and then the tenth, and the whole harmonic spec, and then like chords, and I was like really getting into this thing, and it was incredibly
loud. Did the furniture start levitating?
Well, I'll tell you what happened next. So it was incredibly loud, and I was totally engrossed in it. And then I looked up, and the room was full, and everybody in the place had come in. They'd heard this. And no one else apparently knew how to play this thing. No one had played it like that. It had just been, it arrived from Tibet. It was sitting on the ground, and people had tapped it, you know, and That's it. They hadn't actually played it.
Yeah.
And they were all kind of, you know, and then there was kind of people meditating and people doing like, you know,
some
things,
yoga.
All sorts of stuff. And I'll tell you what, it was completely amazingly, it was beautiful. I felt like I was in a different world. I felt absolutely transported, like a door had opened into
a portal.
But all these people had come walked through this portal, and there we all were, and it was this eternal moment of perfection in sound.
Were you able to go back and record on that same bar?
No. Well, I didn't have recording equipment on the bus. We didn't have any.
Okay.
We didn't have any money. We didn't have any of that sort of stuff. But we had a lot of fun.
That's fantastic.
But then. Yeah, later I heard that Jilly was looking for someone to do. She'd done an album called Mother, and she'd been to New York and played a bit for some festivals, and she was looking to do a second album of fairy tales for her kids and for kids all over the world, old and young. And she got in touch with me because she'd seen my work, and she'd seen that I'd built these harmonic resonator boxes that you could sing into, and it would like be like putting sitar strings on your voice, like, so it was like we called it the pranaphone.
For real?
Pranaphone, yes. Oh. Not the piranha, the pranaphone.
Yeah, like that, like the chi. Yeah.
The phone of breath. And chi, exactly. And so David ordered one of these, David Allen, and Jilly. So he wanted one to play guitar through, and Jilly wanted to put her voice through, and I made them and sent them to them.
Was it acoustic or electronic?
It was an electroacoustic, so it was a box of strings with a large speaker and a pickup. And you tune them to whatever you want, and they resonated. And a special resonating, like a sitar resonating bridge, which buzzed slightly, so you get harmonic series jumping up and down. And that's what the Angel guitar, which is upstairs here, it was based on that idea, but that's slightly different. That's more like two zithers on a guitar, but this was just like you put your voice through it, or any instrument.
Was it the predecessor to a vocoder? But that's just electronic.
There are similarities. I'm taking your question seriously, or your observation seriously. There are similarities in that vocoders use very fine-tuned notch filters to create harmonic series that are driven by alternative inputs, which you don't hear, theoretically. But it is a bit like a vocoder, but it's like an analog vocoder.
Okay.
And it's tunable, so it's a harmonically determinant analog vocoder.
Do you have one here?
Well, the Angel Guitars one.
No. Okay.
I haven't got one of the original ones here,
yes.
No. I've got one of the original ones in the country, Victoria.
Yes.
So I built the Angel guitar originally as a performance instrument that of its own. And I can give you some images of that, actually. You can cut into this if you want. That's a note. But
and you let me play that once when we did that jam with
Russell.
Yeah,
it's kind of an unusual instrument. A few people have used it as an experimental instrument.
It's really
in
amazing.
Different ways, yeah. And it was built at Tony Andrews' factory. He built Turbo Sound and then Now Function One, which is a high-end esoteric audio company that does amazing equipment.
That, is that in England?
It's in England, but they're all over the world. You know, they do festivals in Brazil with a million people in them and stuff like that. Really great sound. Anyway, so that was a lovely contact. So anyway, in the house that I'd been brought up and lived in North Devon, I lived there, went back there 1975, lived there till 1982 where I did these albums, the first two of these albums, and developed Mother Gong, did the Glastonbury festivals, and then in 82 my family decided to sell the house. And so I had a little bit of money. I spent it on coming to Australia. I'd never been to Australia before. I arrived here in the middle of summer, 82, November the 11th, and I was totally shocked. And
Why did you come here instead of, like, say, for example, Los Angeles or something like that?
David Allen, two of Jilly's children with David, Tally and Orlando, their father was in Australia, so we were able to get visas for family reunion purposes. Because their grandmother lived in Melbourne, so we came on that reason, a family reunion ticket. I started building a studio. What else are you going to do? I'd had a studio in England, so I sort of I'll build a studio in Melbourne. Didn't work out. The guy I was building it with decided that he didn't want a studio after I'd built it. Thank you very much. I got a job in the theatre, worked for a year and a half doing musicals, mixing every night, 8 shows a week. I loved that. It was good money. Bought a house, sold that, bought another house, got involved with Richmond Recorders, which had been the studio that Men at Work had recorded Business as Usual and various other, Nick Cave and all those people had worked at, Birthday Party. And in My Sex and lots of well-known bands have recorded there. One of the big studios, early big studios in Melbourne, quite drug-infested, one might say. I wasn't that interested in that. But anyway, we bought a record plant. I learned how to cut, taught myself how to cut records.
Yeah, vinyl.
Vinyl,
and
yeah,
you,
vinyl.
And you had, is that still going now?
Well, I'll tell you very quickly. So we had a record pressing plant in Richmond, in Melbourne, and then after a couple of years, didn't make enough money. Then it was bought by someone else. I worked for them. They were busted by the federal police, making counterfeit copies of albums. The temptation is huge to print your own money. And then it was bought by another guy who was very much more public-spirited, and we ended up doing all sorts of things, including The White Stripes, a live album by The White Stripes and other well-known, more recent bands. And so I cut thousands of sides of albums, and I still maintain the cutting lathe, and, you know, I'm a consultant for that industry. And then I started my own studio in more earnest in 92, and ran that to, it's still going, but I'm now diversifying. I'm not doing bands so much because, honestly, there are some big studios around now, which is nice. There was a time when there were very few studios in Melbourne, and I did 300 or 400 albums. I did some quite big albums and lots of films, and in the last 10 years or so, I've diversified into making pop-up sound booths, of which there's one here, which are used by the ABC, the Army, the Air Force, commercial studios,
Melbourne Police,
emergency management, in fact, also animation studios, just general voiceovers and language laboratories and that sort of thing, and to private individuals.
Is Elon Musk going to take a few to Mars?
I think it would be rather heavy for that purpose.
What, but, you could make them 3D printed ones.
Definitely printable. Definitely printable. Happy to help. And
aren't you doing producing videos too now?
I've been producing videos for 15 years, and I've done 40 or so.
Do you shoot the footage yourself?
I have a crew, so we have five or six people working on a big shoot.
Is this mainly music videos?
These have been mostly music videos and documentaries, but also some art ones and various other things.
Yes.
What am I doing now? Well, I'm doing a lot of the booths and acoustic design of buildings or redesign of buildings, and sailing, which I love, actually.
Yes, now tell us about what's the boat called? It's called the Addiction.
The Addiction. No, it's called Addiction.
Addiction.
A for Addiction. So it goes at the beginning of the fleet. And it's a ocean racer. It's a 39-foot.
Is it a catch?
No, it's a single-masted Bermudan racing boat. It's got a full complement of about 12 sails, takes a crew of 10, sleeps 10, does the West Coaster, which is the real race down to Hobart every year, 60-foot waves, very fast boat downwind, done 28 knots, which is pretty good for a boat of its age. 92 it was built. It's made out of spruce, cross-laminated spruce, and in really big waves, it moves like a dolphin. The skin moves. It's amazing.
Wow.
But it kind of shoots out of the waves. It's a very light boat, very fast.
So now, in the last 3 minutes, tell us about your love of owls.
Oh, well, yes, when I was a kid, my father built a little box up in the top of the roof for the owls to live in, because he liked owls because they balanced the mice. We grew our own food, so it was important that the mice didn't eat all the seeds. And every night the owls would fly out and then come back in dawn. And in my sleep, I would fly with them in my mind and see the world in black and white and silver with extraordinary precision. And it was a spiritual recurring dream. I mean, now I think about it, but for me it was like watching TV in the days before TV. I would just go to sleep and be off with the owls. And many years later I went back to live in the same place where I put the studio, and one night child of a child of a child, and a descendant of that same family of owls, because they all always go to the same place, came to a barn door upstairs in the studio and sat on it. He looked at me plaintively, and I came to the door and looked out downstairs, down to the lower floor, and there was a chick, an owl chick, had fallen out of the nest and was lying on the concrete. And I went downstairs, and the mother was there. She flew down. I went down, picked it up, took it in, made a little box, a little nest for it, gave it some brandy and some sugar to try and fed it up, and the mother just sat by me, near the fire.
That was so cool.
And she was totally cool about it. Like, she was totally relaxed. She wasn't. I mean, she must have been, I don't know what she was thinking, but she wasn't at all nervous.
Yes.
And then she eventually flew off, and then in the morning we found, unfortunately, that she could die, so must have broken its neck or something. But I've always had this connection with owls, and in the bush in here in Highlands we have all sorts of owls, including the powerful owl, the big kind of hawk owl.
Yes.
Which is more like boobok.
Boobok. Yes.
Boobok. Like a giant cuckoo. And they come round and they eat possums. So I have a lot of affinity and love for owls.
Well, look, during the last 30 seconds of this interview, which is just part one of our ongoing series, I can't tell you how cool it is to tell you.
The Anti-Media Radio, your host Nick Burnaby here on UCY.TV.